square. And I have not become well enough to understand him yet, so I brought my own alarm clock. And so while Earl was speaking, it went off. And so I started not to say anything about it and lie and just make him think he was hearing things, you know. But I'm going to try to abide by the time signals on account of Clancy threatened that he had a hook behind this big book back here. I'd like to thank the program committee for asking me to come here, because it was in Southern California that I came to you people. And when he called and asked, about 2 weeks before that, I had been invited to speak in Denver at the International. And let me tell you, my ego really did swell. And I thought I had reached the zenith in my AA career, and that I was going to go up there and lay a lot of wisdom on those people, and plus the fact, the paramount, perhaps, the way that you can return home to your people, the compliment of coming back and talking to you. And so when I went into one of the first meetings in Denver, I heard one of the speakers say, well, we don't have any little shots and we don't have any big shots in AA, because one shot and we're all shot. And so I come to you people as just a newcomer, a beginner. I have been sober today. I have been sober consecutively, a period of 6 years and 9 months. And if you'd ask what happened to me by coming to your program, I would simply say to you that I had an egoectomy and a will transplant. The most important thing, I think, as we talk, is the necessity of keeping our memory green. Because even though I have had this 6 years and 9 months, I, like anybody else, have a tendency to forget, to become complacent, to forget what it was like. And so it's necessary for me to refurbish my memory from time to time. And of course, the easiest way to do this is working with new people. And I find that it's only by working with new people that I am able to identify and relate and remember the way things used to be. I've seen a lot of people who have much time behind them in AA who are complacent, who forget to go to meetings, and who become too important and too busy to work with the new people, and I have seen them get drunk. And it seems to me, and this is my own observation, that it is almost impossible for them to come back to AA. I'm working with a girl now who had 10 years of sobriety. She received her 10th year cake in August, and she was drinking in September, and still is. This is a year and over a year that she's been drinking. And during that period of time, she has lost exactly what everyone said that she would lose, her family and her home, and she's on the streets and she's destitute. And so I can only learn these things, I call them object lessons. And I always know that I cannot forget to remember what I was like, and the same thing can happen to me. When I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous, you people told me that there wasn't anybody that was too dumb to make this program, but that there were a lot of people that were too smart to make it. And I'd like to say to any of you who are here, who are new, who are self-appointed geniuses, as I was, that an intellectual understanding of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is not enough. Because my story is kind of simple. I never got in a whole lot of trouble. I never had to go to jail. I never had to go to a mental institution. I never had to go to a hospital. But throughout my life, I knew all about the program of AA because my mother was a member and at the present time has 24 years of sobriety. But she had come to Alcoholics Anonymous when I was just out of college. And I knew all of you people, and I knew what alcoholics were, and I knew what alcoholics did. And I knew that they had to wreck their cars, and I knew that they had to get fired from jobs. When a lot of people were coming to California, to this very town from Oklahoma, giving Steinbeck the material for the Grapes of Wrath, I was growing up, and we stayed there, and I was an only child. And she then, with her alcoholic tendencies, even though she hadn't been drinking, did the things that alcoholic mothers do. I had 8 baths a day. I was clean. And she'd always say, "Why can't you keep your dress clean like Joe Cleta Petty?" And I still have a resentment against Joe Cleta Petty, and I don't even know where she is. But I had to live a strict, scheduled life. I was a stinking, rotten, spoiled kid. And when I was 13, my little brother was born. And I didn't know at the time that I had a deep-seated resentment against him because I was no longer the center of attention. And my parents had to divide their love, I thought, and that I was left out. And when I was 15 years old, she began drinking. And almost immediately, as I look back, became an alcoholic. And she continued to drink for the next 7 years. But during that period of time in my life, I experienced the same things that all parents of all children of alcoholic parents go through. Because I knew what it was like to come home and not know what the conditions would be when I got there. I didn't know whether I would be slapped or loved. On one occasion, I came home with friends, and the police brought her home. They had just let her out of jail. And I was so ashamed and embarrassed because I didn't want anyone to know that she was my mother. And I said to myself, if there's anything that I'm not going to ever do, I'm not going to ever grow up and be like her. And that resentment started in me when I was very, very young. And it wasn't until I was 38 years old and came to this program that for the first time in my life I understood that she was sick. And though the reasons that she drank were not the reasons that I'd figured out in my sick mind, that she hated me and that she hated my father, she wanted to destroy the family, and that she was a selfish, self-centered person, in a sense, a selfish, self-centered person who cared nothing for us and wanted to humiliate and wanted to embarrass me. And that's the way I lived all those years. And I remember when I was growing up, the only way that I could ever be accepted by my peer group, the kids in my class, was, in my opinion, I had to make better grades. And I'd already developed that feeling of perfectionism, the traits that alcoholics have, because nothing was ever good enough for me. And I was filled with self-condemnation, insecurity, the lack of self-reliance, and there wasn't any place ever that I went that I truly belonged. Well, I graduated from college, and by then I'd started drinking when I was 16. I found the most important thing for the first time in my life that I had ever discovered, and that was what a drink of alcohol would do to me. Now, although I condemned it, as far as she was concerned, it was okay, because once I had that drink inside me, all the fears went away. And the self-reliance was there. And I was somebody. And I was as good as the kid next door. And I was smarter than everyone in my class. And I was popular, I thought, when I drank. In essence, what alcohol did for me when I was that young was just to make me a whole person. Somehow, I was no longer a misfit in society. And somehow, I was meshed in with other human beings, and I was where the action was, and I continued to drink. I drank all the way through college. It wasn't a problem. But at that time, it had become a social lubricant for me, and it was an equalizer because I felt as good as the next guy. And slowly, surely, and insidiously, it became a crutch. because it released all of my suppressed desires, and it relieved my anxieties, and it relieved my depressions. And by the time I was out of college, all of my answers were bottled. I went to law school. I enrolled at Georgetown Law School in Washington, D.C., and I worked on the Hill, and it was there that I had become, that I did become addicted to amphetamine. Now, this was back in 1955, before the kids ever started taking it. And my first exposure was simply to study for law school finals. But after the law school finals were over, with the addictive personality that I had, I continued to take them, and naturally, the dosage had to increase because we develop a tolerance. And so I was taking tranquilizers to come down when I was going to work. I was taking amphetamine to stay up all night and study. And I was drinking along with it. And I was kind of just in a squirrel cage. But somehow or another, this addiction lasted for a period of 14 years, both the pills and the booze. But somehow or another, there for a while, I was able to function. And I don't know, part of my personality, be it defect, you know, now as we understand it, always been that I would set impossible goals, impossible objectives, things that I had to achieve. And whatever it was, I zeroed in on that. And winning was the most important thing in my life. And when I was in law school, I was selected as the first female on the moot court team. Now, at Georgetown Law School, that's very important. It's kind of like being selected as the quarterback on the Oklahoma University team in the Big Eight. But in law school, that was the thing that you had to do. And I sacrificed everything. I had to win that. And that's the way it was with grades in school. And it was just an objective that demanded, it was compulsive, really. And I never understood until I came into Alcoholics Anonymous that this competitive nature that I had developed was of necessity because of my own insecurity and my own perfectionism. On the count of I always had to be better than everyone else because I never felt as good as. And it didn't make any difference what it was I had to achieve in it. I returned to the University of Oklahoma and took my last year of law there. And when I got out, I got the best job that any law graduate could get. And I went to work as a clerk for the chief judge of the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals. And I was still drinking and I was still taking booze. But somehow or another, I managed to hang on because alcoholics, I think, have that desire to survive above all. And we're going to hang on as long as we can, clear and, well, to the doors of death. We're going to stay in there. We're going to give it our best shot. In 1959, I had been married and divorced, and I had a child. 1960, I remarried and had two more children. And it added up that I had had three children in about 3.5 years. And with this alcoholic nature that I had, responsibility was just entirely too much for me to handle. And so I transferred the resentment and the hate that I had upon these children because I felt like that they were holding me back. And it had always been my great ambition to become the female Clarence Darrow of this nation. And I had always wanted, when I drank, I just wanted to have class. I wanted to be a lady. And I wanted to be mysterious and intriguing and sexy. And I was for a minute until I either... and I was until I either passed out or threw up on my plate. But it just seemed that I could just never hang in there long enough with alcohol to accomplish the objective, whoever or whatever. With these children, we moved to California in 1962 to Los Angeles. We lived there until 65, went back to Oklahoma, came back in 66, and I was doing the Geographic all the time. If I can just have my chance, I don't know what at, but nevertheless, I just knew that someday it was all going to be okay. And along with the drinking and along with the emotional sickness that is its companion, there was the guilt and the remorse. And the more I drank, the guiltier I felt, the greater the remorse. There's an old saying in Zen that you cannot wash away blood with blood. And that's the story of my drinking career, because as things would happen, I would just drink more. And then I would get into some trouble, and then I would try to drink to forget that. I had gone to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous when I was 29 years old, when we were holding court, federal court in Denver. And I listened to you people. The reason that I went was because I had a terrible hangover, and I was going to try to learn how to drink socially. And so, as I listened to what was said, I didn't hear. Because I heard people talk about having lost everything. Their families, their jobs, their self-respect. And when I was 29, none of those things had happened to me. And I left knowing, making again the second most important decision of my life, that I was not an alcoholic. And so I had to go out and I had to drink for 9 more years. I went to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in 1966 when we first came back to California. It was in Santa Monica. And again, I didn't hear what you said. I was dying inside, but I knew if there was one thing that I would never be, it would be an alcoholic like my mother. Of course, she'd been sober for many years at this time. The things that happened to me during the last 12 to 9 months, I call fast acceleration downhill. The hate and the resentment that was manifested in me towards my children was unbelievable. Those are little kids, and they were aged 5, 6, and 7, would come into my kitchen when I was in there, and I was drinking around the clock. And they'd come in there to get a cookie or a glass of milk. And my hate had been transferred on those children to the extent that I consciously, and I was sober, consciously shut the drawers that contained the knives, because I had an irresistible impulse to kill them. Now, I had planned a lot of deaths for a lot of people. For example, this one mother-in-law that I had, who was alcoholic, naturally we didn't get along. This was not the last one. We didn't get along either. But nevertheless, I decided one evening that I was going to go kill the entire family. And so my plan was, it was winter, and I was going to wait until the ground was frozen so that it wouldn't leave my footprints. And I was going to go over, and they knew that they had fires on in the house, and I was going to get a pipe wrench and go up to the gas meter outside and take the pipe wrench and turn the gas off and wait about 3 minutes, and the flame would go out, and I was going to turn the gas back on. I got the pipe wrench and a fifth of whiskey, and I never got there. But the important thing is that I was capable of doing those things. I can recall on my little girl's 4th birthday having every good intention of baking her a birthday cake and having a birthday party with the kids over. And I remember that I woke up at 7 o'clock that night, and I'd passed out, and the kids had come and gone, and the presents were all over the floor, and I wasn't there for a party. And I remember on several occasions, my husband would have to pull me off of those children because I would be drinking and beating them. And I have seen bruises on their body the next day. And if anyone doubts that second step as far as insanity is concerned, let me say that I was completely, I believe this, completely and totally insane. And so in February of 1969, I made the third most important decision in my life, because I had reached the point in surrender where I was not, I didn't want to get rid of a friend. I wanted to get rid of an enemy. And psychologically, that is what had happened to me. And so, on that evening, knowing that I hated you with every ounce in my body, I hated members of Alcoholics Anonymous. I called you people. And I reflected on the things that I had done to you. I remember that when my mother was sober, she would do 12-step work. And she'd bring people into our homes, and I called them those old stinking, puking drunks. And she'd bring them in, and she'd try to make a cup of coffee and get it down them. And my reaction was, and I told her, I said, I think that you ought to sterilize those coffee cups because those drunks have got venereal disease. And that was my attitude towards you, even in 1969. And I remember she sponsored one young man who we'd known him for a long time. And this guy called a lot, you know, like we all do with our sponsors. And she and another gentleman who had some time in AA were trying to help this guy. And he was having an awful time. And this guy called about 50 times a day. And I'd answer the telephone and he'd say, "Hi, is your mom there? This is Jack." I'd say, "Just a minute." And I'd slam that phone down as hard as I could, hoping that it would rupture his eardrum and that he wouldn't call anymore. And then one day I was home and the telephone rang. I was alone. And Jack's wife called. And she said, "Is your mom there?" I said, "No, she's not here." And she said, "Well, when she gets back, would you tell her that Jack died? He had a heart attack." And my reaction at that time was, "Good, he won't call anymore." And that's what I thought about you people. Well, this evening, February the 11th, it took a stinking, puking drunk to call you stinking, puking drunks. And you people came that night, and I listened. And you told me it was going to be okay. And for the first time in my life, I felt like I was able to communicate. And I told you how I felt inside. I told you that I felt like I was in an open grave and that people were just coming by and kicking dirt in on me. And you said, "We know, Yvonne." And I told you that I was scared to death. I was unable to go to the grocery store. I was unable to drive a car, and didn't for a while after I came into AA. I was afraid to answer the telephone. And you people said, "Yvonne, we know. We have been through these things." And those magic words, "We know," gave me the hope just to get through that night. For those of you who are new, if you don't know what hope is, I call it just a shirt tail, and you just grab it and you hang on to it for dear life. If you don't understand what's happening, you just hang on. And I made it through the night, and you people started calling me the next morning because you knew that I drank in the morning. And you called me all day, about every 15 minutes, and in between times I called you. And so I went to my first meeting. And all of a sudden, the realization hit me that all the things that I wanted to be, all of the dreams and the ideals that I had were gone. Life to me was just like a merry-go-round, and I was just waiting for some day to get that brass ring. Just some day I was going to get that pie in the sky. Some day things were going to be different for me. I was incapable of reading. I couldn't understand a law book. And yet, when I came to meetings where you people were, I felt as though I belonged. On the count of you understood what my silent screams were inside. And I listened. And then after I'd been sober about 2 weeks, I became arrogant. I became condescending. I became brilliant. And one man that had been sober for many years said to me, "If you're so damn smart, how come you're a drunk?" And I didn't have any answer. But you people told me that alcohol was not my problem, that it was my solution. And for some reason I listened to you. And I think that the reason was that you didn't talk to me with authority, because I rebelled at that. And you didn't say to me, "Yvonne, do as I say." You said, "Do as I did." And somehow you laid out the path for me to follow. And there was compassion. And it didn't make any difference how much I screamed or yelled. You listened. I was caught short a couple of times. But I did what I was told to do, to follow the prescription of sobriety. And you told me that I couldn't take any more pills, that I couldn't drink any more booze, and that I was going to have to stand reality without any chemicals. And you substituted in the place of chemicals this program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's the greatest thing that has ever happened to me since I took my first drink. And I couldn't work the program of AA until I had taken my first step and until I had quit drinking, because AA just doesn't work that way. You have to sober up before you can even start. And you explained to me that this program that you were showing me was not a utopia, that it was not a Shangri-La, and that I had to be the little red hen and that I had to work the steps. I could not learn vicariously, that it took action on my part. And I rebelled, because I found out that I was emotionally a child, though I had the body of a 38-year-old woman, and like a child, there's no way that I could stand any change, because I have always resisted everything that has ever happened to me. And if you take a child now, and he's on the floor, and he's playing, and you try to take a toy from him and substitute something else, there is resistance, because there is a feeling of deprivation. And that's how I felt. What are you going to give me instead? But I listened to you people. And slowly but surely it began to soak in. And it's the first time in my life that I ever did the things that I was told to do. And I didn't do them because I wanted to. I did them because I hurt so bad that I had no choice. And of necessity, I had to work these steps. And I learned that the problem, it's like one of the speakers said today, the problem was me, not alcohol. And I have always likened it to an automobile accident. It is not the fuel that is at fault. It is the driver. And I had to learn through the taking of these steps that the character defects that I had would remain with me the rest of my life. And I had to learn that I must analyze to a certain extent on a daily basis what my motivations were, because in most instances they were wrong. I learned about ego. I learned that ego to me was like a beggar with a cup, begging constantly for praise, for special privilege, for support, for patronage, and that my ego was insatiable, kind of like the heroin habit. That it had to be fed constantly, and the more that it was fed, the more I demanded. And I learned that pride was an illusion based upon the approval of other people. I was so afraid that I would lose face. And both of these defects are a result of my feeling the lack of self-worth or self-reliance. And then I had to learn about perfectionism. And I still have all of these problems today, but at least the difference is that I understand what's wrong. And I had to learn that the reason that I was a perfectionist is because I was constantly comparing myself with other people. And again, I had that image of superiority, and I had to be better. My house had to be cleaner. My drawers had to be more organized. Everything about me had to be perfect because I had to have the approval of other people. I had to set standards for them because they were inferior to me. And I was always competitive, because of comparison. And then I learned about self-pity. And I learned that self-pity, again, is based upon comparison. Because when I was on my pity pot, I was always comparing my life with the plight of someone else. That she had a better deal, or they had a new car, or their house was nicer, or look at the work that I have to do. Back home, we say that when you're on your pity pot, it's just poor me, and then pour me a drink. And that's what you told me. That the end result of pity, unless there is a severance of that emotion and it is weeded out, will result in a drunk. And I learned about impatience. And I learned that the only time for a child is now. And I learned that I was a child. And I learned that I had complete and total disregard for other people. And that they had to do things as I wanted them done. And I learned that impatience, again, was the result of self-centeredness, which on the opposite side of the coin was the lack of self-reliance. And then I had to learn about guilt. The amazing thing to me was that in this program of AA, we used our mouths to get sick with, and then we used them to get well. And you shared with me your experiences, and you explained to me. You said over and over that there is no one who comes into AA who does not possess an extreme amount of guilt and remorse. And I felt that I was the only one. That's his alarm. That's not mine. And you told me that my guilt was not because I had such high moral standards, and I always thought I had been very Victorian, but you said that the reason that I had guilt was because I was afraid of being found out, the things that I had done, and again that I was seeking the approval of other people. And I learned that I carried a lot of unnecessary guilt. Because in many instances, the fact that I just wake up in the morning, you know, would make me feel guilty. Particularly if I hadn't remembered what I had done the night before. But I learned through your analysis and through watching other people take their own inventories, the things that were the motivating factors inside me, which were making me emotionally sick, and making me find some kind of anesthetic for my pain. Now, one trick that I did, and let me say to you, that I have done everything wrong on this program since I have been in AA, with the exception of two things, and that's drink and take pills. And one thing that I can say to you, if you are new, is do not do what I did about taking an inventory. Because over a period of 3.5 years, I had divided my inventory up, and I took a little bit with one person, and a little bit with another, and a little bit with another, because I just didn't feel like I could lay it all on the same guy. And invariably, when I would take my inventory with these people, they would say to me, "Well, Yvonne, that's not really so bad." And you know, that was all I wanted, was the pat on the back. Because that removed a lot of guilt for me. And so when I was sober 3.5 years, they had asked me to speak at the Top of Texas conference in Amarillo. And the night before I was to talk, I knew that I could not go to the podium because I had nothing to say to you people. And I knew inside that I was a hypocrite, and I knew that I could not share my experience in working this AA program with you because I had not done the things that you told me to do. I'd found the shortcuts, which is part of the thing that I had always done, to get it the fastest. And so I talked with a gentleman there that night, and he said, you must take a complete and thorough inventory. And I went home to Oklahoma City, and about a month later I flew out here, and I took my fifth step. And it is only since that time that I have really begun to understand Yvonne, that she is a human being, that she wasn't all bad, and that I have understood the feelings that I have of the lack of self-worth, and that I understand the reasons that I do things now because of the character defects which I had never been able to isolate nor identify before. I learned about anxiety, which is a constant companion with some of us, and I learned that these fits of anxiety that I had, I always describe them as free-floating ghosts just waiting for a house to haunt and just go in. And I learned that my anxiety is nothing in the world except hostility, which is mask. That's all. That it is the same negative feeling. And the difference is that with hostility, I am there on the scene and hostile. And with an anxiety, I am running from it and standing apart, which is what I want to do. With hostility, I'd knock on my neighbor's door and hit him in the mouth. And with anxiety, I'd sit home and worry about it, and hate, and wonder what was going to happen. And then I had to come to the spiritual part of this program. And that was pretty difficult for me because I didn't have much going with God when I came here. I'd been raised in the Bible Belt, and the kind of God that we had a lightning bolt in one hand and a black whip in the other. And he was a bookkeeper, one of punishment, condemnation, and all they taught us was sin. And when you're a kid and you're growing up in that kind of an atmosphere, there ain't no way that you're going to have any kind of a feeling or love towards God, because you know that whatever it is that you've done, he's going to get you. And everything that happened to me, I figured that he had. I didn't understand that the things that happened were consequences of my acts. Instead, I felt as though I were being punished. And you came to me and you said, you're going to have to start having some faith. And we want you to love a God of your understanding. And my answer to you was, the only kind of God that I know is the kind of God that the preacher talks about from the pulpit. And that God is the kind of God that let his son be cruelly crucified on the cross and told me that if I didn't believe that, I was going to go to hell. And you people said to me, you have got to learn that God loves you. And I think that that was probably, if you could define it, my spiritual awakening, because you kept telling me over and over that God loved me. And I was just nothing. I was so dirty and impure on the inside, there was no way that I could stand before any kind of a higher power and have that entity care for me. And so you said, you pray to stay sober in the morning, and at night you thank God that you've stayed sober. And I didn't believe in that kind of a God, but I gave it lip service. And it was a long, laborious, impossible at times process for me to develop any faith. But you know, the beginning of it was that after 2 months, I was still sober. And I sang them dumb prayers. Every day. 4 months, I was still sewing and think, hey, this might work. This thing that they've got, this higher power. And over a slow period of time, I began to develop some faith. And on the one hand, it seems controversial, you know, to a lot of people. Because I've heard about it in meetings and they discuss it, and it's really kind of inconsistent because they say you're going to come to Alcoholics Anonymous and you're going to grow up. And on the other hand, the kind of faith that they give us is like that of a little child. And that's the kind of faith that I had to develop, just an undoubting trust. And I've heard it said at one of the meetings that I first attended in Los Angeles, that it's like walking up to an abyss that is dark and black with no knowledge of what's out there. And them dumb members of AA just say, jump! And you do. Now that's faith. The undoubting trust of knowing that it's all going to be okay. I have said a lot of times, and each time,
I beg your pardon?
I can't see the neon signs up here because of the light, so he's going to have to pull my coattail like Hope with a shirt and just hang on. What I was talking about was that it is, you have said, you know, that we have to accept this God that we have like a child. And it's like kind of your parent treated you when you were growing up. You know, you knew it was going to be okay. And if you were sick, you knew that the parent would be there. And that there would be love. And that there would be understanding. And that's kind of the way that I found that I had to feel. That there was going to be love and understanding. And that I knew that it was going to be okay. I've often said that there's a movie that reminds me of this spiritual breakthrough, if you want to call it that. And it was The Wizard of Oz, and I saw that when I was a little girl. And I remember how scared I was when Dorothy went down that yellow brick road, and they went into the castle, and they went into that room where that wizard was, and they had a big green screen, and they had a big, huge face, and a lot of noise and thunder, and she was frightened. Because they didn't know, and it was the fear of the unknown, of this all-powerful being. And that's kind of the way that I was when I came to AA. Just fear and hate and resentment. And you people taught me that even when we say the Lord's Prayer, we say trespasses, but in some churches they say debts, that we cancel our debts. And that's a metaphor, and that means to me simply that you cannot forgive someone and punish them at the same time. It is impossible. Just like you cannot cancel a debt and collect on it at the same time. And if my children come to me and they say, Mother, we are sorry that we did so-and-so, and I forgive them, there's no way that I can whip them. And that's the kind of feeling that I have to have. You know, I don't think you have to crochet a prayer. I think it can be a simple thing. And this program doesn't have anything about these and thous, you know. It's just us in our relationship. And I have often heard it said that the only thing that stands between man and God is his ego. And I have learned that it is my ego that is the thing that is offended in all of my relationships with other human beings, and that's all, just my ego. It's the only thing about me that gets hurt or hurts another person. And I know that I'm going to have to work on this the rest of my sober life. And that, of course, is with my action and your help and God's blessing. I had been sober for 3.5 years, and it was necessary for me to divorce the man who had been through the most severe part of my drinking. And I had mixed emotions about that because I felt so indebted. I felt grateful in a way because he was always there And he took care of those kids and he protected them from me. But they said to us when I came to AA that you are either going to grow together or you're going to grow apart. And I didn't believe them, but it's true. On the count of I tried to work my program, and somehow or another, after 3.5 years, we didn't know each other because I was not the person that he had married, and then vice versa. And so with this divorce came the things that alcoholics have in regression. And there was hate and resentment and vindictiveness and all the things except not drinking or taking pills. That's all. And it took a long time to take this program and to put it into action in my daily living in order for me to relieve my resentment and my hate towards him. And I want to say to you today, from the bottom of my heart, that I have none now. I have no resentment. But it took months and months, and then I'd be okay, and then it'd come back. And then I'd be okay. And I think at this point in time that it's finally over with, and I feel like a free person. I went back to the state of Oklahoma, and I became an assistant attorney general in the criminal division. And it was my job to prosecute drunken drivers, drug peddlers. You know, and all the time I'm thinking to myself, there but for the grace of God go I. Because I knew that I had been guilty of the same things, and everyone in this room, all of us, you know, if justice were really enforced, we'd all be in jail for the things that we'd done. And I worked there for 2 years, and I loved that job. Not particularly what I was talking about, but I loved the brief writing, and I loved the research. And my head was together, and I had everything going for me. And then 2.5 years ago, I was asked if I would accept an appointment and go on the bench. And I was appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate to become the first female state judge in the history of Oklahoma. And that's the job that I have now. Now, the only way that I can be removed from that office is with cause, and that's for excessive drinking, and with the help of you people, I'm going to stay there. And a lot of things have happened since that period that I went through with all of that resentment and hate, because I've had to grow on this program of necessity. I built a house. My kids started in preteen and in Alateen. I started working with newcomers. I got myself out of the middle. I started giving my time to the suffering alcoholic. I started participating. I started leading in meetings. I read Chapter 5. I did all the things that I had to do when I first came to you people. Because like to me, it was just starting all over. Because the hate that I had and the fear of the responsibility of that family, not only taking care of but providing financially for those children, had enveloped me in such a fear that I just could not function. And so I had to take a marriage inventory, and I had to take an inventory after it was over with of the fears. And I started again, and I began to grow. And I grew of necessity and out of pain. There was a gentleman who had practiced in my court for a number of years, who was a widower. And if I tell you how it started, well, my dog was in heat. No, I can't. Okay. And I have a Great Dane dog, and he had a male Great Dane dog, and I called him to borrow his dog. And then we went through a whole thing of those puppies, you know, and having the puppies, which turned out to be German shepherds, but no. But nevertheless, we have a fine relationship, and we were married August the 22nd. He's an excellent attorney with one of the finest, and let me add, most conservative, law firms in the state. We're exactly the opposite in our temperament and personality. And before we entered into this contract, I told him in the beginning that I was an alcoholic and that I would always be an alcoholic, and he knew nothing about alcoholism or AA. And I told him that it was absolutely necessary for me that AA come first in my life, before anything, before my kids, before him or my job, and that it would be necessary for him to attend Al-Anon meetings. And he does. And he doesn't understand, because he doesn't relate to the people who have had drinking, alcoholic spouses. But he tries, and he took his third step about 2 weeks ago because I was his higher power and made him. And the problems that we have now are really an integrating and meshing of our personalities, on the count of the thing that, kind of bothers me a little is that he is so self-sufficient you just can't stand it. And he is so organized and so orderly and has everything perfect and running, and he makes the calls when anything goes wrong, and he handles all the problems, which I object to because it takes me out of control. And so occasionally, I get to make a decision. And the amazing thing to me about this program is that all the time that I was drinking, I was incapable of even making a decision when I went to the grocery store. I couldn't decide whether I was going to buy soap or cereal. And now then, that crazy, dumb state of Oklahoma is paying me to make decisions. And I do it every day. And I try to apply this program in my daily living. And sometimes I don't do so well. And sometimes the days are just great. But I have to keep my memory green of the way that it used to be. And I can't forget to remember that I can be back where I was. That if I don't do the things that are required of me in AA. And this Wizard of Oz, I found the wizard, and it was like the Tin Man. I got a heart, and it was like the Scarecrow, because I got my head back together. And it was like the Lion, because I got some courage. And I know that I come to you people, and I pour my heart out. And I know that only with the gentlest of hands, you will separate the wheat from the chaff. And with the breath of kindness, you're going to blow away what's unwanted and unneeded. And I know that no matter how bad things are for me, I know that you are going to share in my adversity and in my grief by dividing it. Just recently, in March, my father had a heart attack, most serious, and I found that I was going through the same things then emotionally that I did when I first came to you people. And they were denial that it had happened, like denial of my alcoholism, rebellion against God because I said, why him, God? Just like when I was drinking. And then complete and total surrender, putting his life out of my control. And then faith. And then trust. And those are the exact steps that I went through. To ask me how AA works, I can't tell you. I can say to you that it's like trying to describe the color white to someone who is blind. And you say to them, it's like snow. And the blind man thinks that that color means cold and wet, because a visual description won't answer. That's the way it is in AA. It's that we have to experience and go through these things. Now, what am I supposed to give back this gift of sobriety that you have given to me, what can I give back for my life? All I can ever hope to do is just be the link in the chain of sobriety for someone else who comes who is new. And if there's a guy on the ladder that's a rung behind me, just to reach down and just give him a hand, a boost and a lift, and let him know that I'm there. For whenever anyone anywhere reaches out for the hand of AA, I want the hand of AA to be there. And for that, I am responsible. God bless you.